This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Veteran director Woody Allen is having a good year. His most recent film, Midnight in Paris, is nominated for the Best Picture Oscar, and Allen's nominated for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay. Midnight in Paris tells the story of a writer, played by Owen Wilson, who comes to Paris with his fiancée and her parents, and he finds himself time-traveling to his favorite era, 1920s France. Every night when the clock strikes midnight, he meets famous writers and artists of the period, and on this night, he's introduced to a writer who happens to be one of his idols.
Now, this is a writer, Gil. Yes, Gil.
Gil Pender.
Gil Pender.
Hemingway.
Hemingway?
You liked my book.
Liked? I loved all your work.
Yes, it was a good book because it was an honest book. And that's what war does to men. And there's nothing fine and noble about dying in the mud, unless you die gracefully. And then it's not only noble, but brave.
Hemingway is played by Corey Stoll. Woody Allen has directed more than 40 films. He's been nominated for 17 Academy Awards and has won 3, including Best Writer and Best Director for Annie Hall. Terry spoke to Woody Allen in 2009 when his film Whatever Works was released. They began with a classic scene from Annie Hall.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know, and such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly.
Woody Allen, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it's interesting how your characters try to find pleasure in a life full of pain. My impression of you is that you're the kind of person for whom pleasure is hard to come by, in part because you've said you're claustrophobic, agoraphobic. Annie Hall was originally going to be named anhedonia, which means an inability to experience pleasure. Is pleasure hard to come by, even when you're working to find it?
I do. There are a number of things that give me pleasure, but you know, hanging over the pleasure is always the dark cloud of you know, the human predicament, so that I can get pleasure when I'm playing with my children or I'm doing something with my wife or playing jazz. I like to play music, and I do find it pleasurable, but these are transient oases in a vast desert of unspeakable gloom, you know. But I do get pleasure. Like everyone else, it's pleasurable for me to go to a basketball game, or, you know, but always overriding it is the notion that it's you know, ephemeral, very, very ephemeral.
Now, you started in comedy by writing jokes, and you were writing for an older generation. What was the pay like? Did they pay you per joke or per joke that they used?
No, the pay was a lot. I mean, at the time, you know, when you think that my father and mother both had to work their whole life. My father drove a cab and was a bartender, was a bookmaker, and ran a pool room. My mother always worked in the flower market. And they had to combine their salaries. And I started working, and you know, their combined salaries would be, you know, maybe less than $100 a week combined. And I started working, and the immediately I was making close to $200 a week. I was 17 years old and I was making that. And before long, I was making $1,500 a week. And in those days, I mean, this was the early 50s.
That was a lot of money.
You know, the mid-50s. And it was more than my parents put together would make in ages. So the show business salaries, I always felt were way out of whack with reality. Now, I haven't made a big protest over that over the years, you'll notice. But I always did feel that they were, you know, when you see what a school teacher gets and what some terrible comedian gets or some awful singer gets, you know, it's shocking.
Did you say your father worked in a pool room and he was a bookmaker?
Yeah, my father had a lot of jobs. He was always scuffling to make a living. He sold jewelry. He was a waiter. He was a bartender. He was a cab driver. He ran a pool room. He was a bookmaker for a while.
You must have met a lot of colorful characters through him, unless you were not welcome in that world.
I was young to have met the colorful characters, but he was always bringing home stolen merchandise. And, you know, that was fenced to him for no money at all. So he'd always be coming home with, you know, a fur coat for my mother or a typewriter or a tape recorder or this, you know, and pick this up for $2 and this up for $20. And, you know, there was a lot of that over the years, a lot of stuff bought. I remember that. You know, fenced junk.
Were you supposed to keep that a secret, that it was fenced?
It was never expressed that way. It was, you know, it was that he came home with a bargain and,
right.
You know, that, and you say, my God, where did you get that, you know, electric typewriter for $1.25? It's brand new. And, you know, but you never knew that. And my father was an inveterate numbers player. There was not a day in his life that he didn't play the numbers, and whenever he won, you know, it was money for everybody. I mean, he just spread it around, you know, like Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners. I mean, he just, everybody, you know, it was such a pleasure if he came home and had hit his number. You know, my sister and I and my mother all knew we were going to be rewarded with an extravagant bonus.
Can you describe the neighborhood you grew up in? A lot of people imagine you growing up under the roller coaster in Coney Island, like your character in
Annie
Hall.
Right. People think that. No, I grew up in a very nice section of Brooklyn called Flatbush. And when I grew up there, it was a lovely, you know, it was a lovely section. I mean, there was ball field and playground. There were many, many, many movie houses within, you know, walking distance of, no matter where you were dropped, you'd be within walking distance of a couple of movie houses. And the blocks were tree-lined and safe, and you could go out and play ball all day long in the streets and schoolyards. And it was a very nice neighborhood.
What was your parents' relationship like, and what did it make you think marriage was like?
Marriage for my parents was kind of like what it was in all the other neighboring houses and friends' houses. It was a long truce, is what it was. All the parents in the neighborhood, the men and women, they loved each other. There were people who were from the Depression, and so money was a big factor because nobody had any real money and everybody had to work. But usually what would happen is the men and the women would – the guys would work all day and they'd come home. And then on the weekends, the guys would take bridge chairs out and play cards at a table, and the women would keep with the women. There was no sense that a guy was coming home on the weekend so he could take his wife and, you know, leave the son with a babysitter or the daughter with a babysitter and check into a hotel and have a romantic weekend or do something romantic. There wasn't that. The guys would be, you know, watching the ball game, or not watching so much, listening on the radio to the ball games together. They'd be playing poker or gin rummy or pinochle together. And that's how it was even when there was a dinner or something. The uncles and relatives would get together. And as soon as the dinner was over, the guys would be in the other room around a card table. And the women would be talking in their room about, you know, and you didn't get a sense. You didn't come away with a sense of romantic passion. There wasn't much interpersonal charm to it.
I know that your movies aren't your life, but there's a scene in Annie Hall that is just like so funny, and I feel like I know these people. It's the dinner scene where you're at dinner with Diane Keaton, Annie Hall's family, and it's a much more kind of formal, you know, quiet, polite, everybody eating slowly kind of setting. And you compare that in your mind with the family dinners you were used to, where people are like shoveling down the food and hollering at each other and everybody's aggravated and talking about who has diabetes. Was dinner like that at home?
Dinner was not really like that at home, no, because, you know, I ate by myself at, 5:30, and my mother ate at 6:30 after she had made dinner for my sister and myself, and my father got home at 8:45, and he would have that stuff was made up and exaggerated for comic purposes.
How come you ate alone?
I ate alone because I like to eat alone, because I like, you know, I like the solitude. I like to, you know, eat and read a comic book or something. And
your parents let you do that without accusing you of being antisocial and turning your back on the family?
They were so happy that I wanted to eat alone. You know, no, because we always lived with aunts and uncles and things, and my mother would have a better time eating with her sister, or if my father got home in time and she was waiting for him, with him. But, you know, what am I going to talk about with my mother? I was 10 years old, or 9 or 11, and out in the streets all day playing stickball, and, you know, we had nothing to talk about.
Woody Allen speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview with Woody Allen. His film Midnight in Paris is nominated for the Best Picture Oscar, and Allen's nominated for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay. They spoke in 2009, after his film Whatever Works was released. It starred Larry David as an eccentric New Yorker who meets a young girl from the South.
In the movie, Larry David is in his 50s, and Evan Rachel Wood is still in her teens when she shows up kind of homeless on his doorstep, and he decides, kind of against his will to and against his better judgment, to take her in and give her a few meals and then to let her live there, and then they get married. So forgive me for asking this, because this is a little personal, but this was written before, like long before you married Sun Yi, but it means, let's be honest, that everyone's going to be looking for clues in this movie about your relationship with your wife. And and again, let's be honest, a lot of your fans were really kind of upset when you married the woman who was the adoptive daughter of your longtime lover. So I wonder if you thought about that kind of thing when you were making the movie, that people would just be like looking for clues about the older man, younger woman relationship and how
people,
that applies to you.
People do look for clues in my movies all the time.
For who you
in
really
all my
are.
Movies.
Uh-huh.
The people always look for clues in my movies, and they think based on my movies that they know me. And of course they don't know me. And there are some things you could have learned about me over the years, but not much really. You know, I was never who anybody thought I was from when I started. When I first started as a comic in Greenwich Village, people thought that I was, at that time, some kind of a little beatnik and someone who, you know, was a kind of mousy intellectual. And, you know, none of these things were ever true. I never lived in the village. I always lived in a very nice neighborhood uptown in Manhattan. I was never intellectual. I was never interested in intellectual things. You know, when I explain to people, I'm the guy that you see in his T-shirt with a beer watching the baseball game at night at home on television, they find that hard to square with the characters that I've played in the movies. But in the movies, I'm just acting. But I've never been, you know, I was always a very athletic little boy, always, you know, never a loner or a loser, always the first one picked on any team.
You were the first one picked on any team?
Always.
See, I wouldn't have believed that.
I know. I was always
very
good athlete. I was interested even in playing professional baseball. I was, you know, won track medals. You know, but nobody thinks of me that way. They think of me as, you know, some kind of little bookworm, because I have these big black glasses, black rimmed glasses, and they think of me as a bookworm and give me more credit for intellect than I have. And, I couldn't make it. I couldn't make it through college. I couldn't make it through my freshman year of college. And this was not because I was some, artist or intellectual above it. I couldn't cut it. I mean, I wasn't.
You flunked out?
Couldn't get them. I flunked out. I was thrown out of New York University in my first year there.
What did you fail?
Because I couldn't get the marks.
In what subjects?
I was a motion picture production major. I had to take regular subjects as well.
Don't tell me you failed motion
English
picture classes.
And Spanish and subjects like that. I failed those subjects. And I didn't do well in motion picture production either.
Was this because you were busy writing jokes for other people?
I wasn't too busy. I was uninterested. I mean, I played ball. I was, as I say, I was athletic. I played cards. I liked to. I wasn't interested in erudition and education. Those are not things that I was not brought up to be interested in that, and I wasn't interested. I didn't see it in my home, and this is long winded, but just to say that people have. Are constantly looking for clues to me in my work and seizing on things that are quite, quite unrepresentative of who I really am.
When people love somebody's art, they become very interested in the artist, and that leads them to be interested in the artist's personal life or what they can find out about it. And like some of your fans felt just upset and in some ways even betrayed maybe because of your marriage to Sun Yi, and they started reevaluating, well, do I see his films differently now? I think a lot of people went back and rewatched Manhattan or thought about Manhattan because it's the story of an older man and a younger woman, a middle-aged man and a teenager. Do you think it's fair or wrong to to evaluate an artist's work by decisions they've made or what you think of decisions they've made in their personal life? Or do you think that that's...
I think you can evaluate an artist any way you choose to. You're free to evaluate an artist in any way that you want to, based on anything that makes you happy.
And do you care what people think of your personal life? Or is that just irrelevant to you?
Well, do you care? If I say I don't care, it sounds so cold and callous. But let me put it this way. How could you go through life, taking direction from the outside world? I mean, what kind of life would you have, if you made your decisions based on, the outside world and not what your inner dictates told you? You would have a very inauthentic life.
So you told us you didn't eat with your family. Do you eat when you were growing up that you ate alone because you liked to be alone with your comic book at dinner?
Yeah.
And your parents preferred the company of adults. Do you eat with your children now?
I eat with the children, yeah, but because they like our company, and the generations are different. I'm much closer to my children than my parents were to me. My kids and I... and my wife, talk about the same subjects, and we're all friends. Now I'm an older parent, but I'm still a parent in a younger generation than the generation that I grew up in. Obviously, I do eat with my children, and we like it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Woody Allen speaking with Terry Gross in 2009. Allen's film Midnight in Paris is nominated for the Best Picture Oscar, and Allen's nominated for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay. Here's Sidney Bechet from the soundtrack of the film. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over.
Etta James, the legendary rhythm and blues and pop vocalist, died last week due to complications from leukemia. She was 73. James started recording at the age of 15 and had her first hit when she was just 17. She became an established R&B vocalist, but also had successful pop hits, including her best known, At Last, recorded in 1961. John Perellas of the New York Times wrote in 1990 that she had one of the great voices in American popular music, with a huge range, a multiplicity of tones, and vast reserves of volume. Etta James had an erratic career as tastes in popular music evolved, and she battled heroin and cocaine addictions. But she won 4 Grammy Awards and is in both the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Blues Hall of Fame. Terry spoke with Etta James in 1994.
You grew up in a foster home. I think when your mother had you, she was 14 years old.
Right. She was a kid. And, you know, I had feelings about all that kind of stuff for years, and I went to therapy and all about it. But then as I got older, I realized that she really did the best for me. She put me in a lovely home. The people were, you know, lovely to me. They never said that they were my real parents. I mean, I always knew I had this good-looking, you know, high-stepping mom, and she was like only 14 years older than me. And so she did the best for me, because if she had tried to take me with her, she was just a child, what would she have done with me? Would I have been singing today? Would I have been anything, you know?
What was your foster family like?
They were lovely. They were older people. And they had property, and they lived in the east side, lower east side of Los Angeles. And my grandmother was a church lady, and they believed in, they gave me singing lessons at 5.
When you were singing in the church choir, did your grandmother or anyone else in the family get upset if on your own time you sang blues or any kind of secular music?
No, because my grandmother died when I was 12. So I sang gospel music from 5 until 12. And so my grandmother, she wasn't one of those kind of people, because I was already the prodigy child of the church. And I did nothing but, and I loved church. I went to Bible camp, and I was a little Christian girl. And until my grandmother passed away at 12, that is when my mother came to get me. Because I had nothing but my grandfather there in the house, and my mother wanted me to be with her. And she came the day of the funeral to pick me up, to take me back to San Francisco. So that's at San Francisco. Oh, I was listening to little stuff on the sly, but I wasn't interested in secular music. But once I got to San Francisco, I grew horns and a tail. And I really turned into, you know, the real street kid. I was kind of like a runaway, but I had a mother, you know what I mean? And I had a place to stay.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to play one of your rhythm and blues recordings that has a very gospel sound to it. And I want to play Something's Got a Hold on Me from 1961. Do you think of this as having a gospel sound?
Matter of fact, it is a gospel song. We wrote that song, and we adapted it from a gospel song, and the gospel song was Something's Got a Hold on Me, It Must Be the Lord.
And in your song, it must be love.
It must be love, right, right. Now, don't get me, because I'm not the one who decided to, but I was one of the writers. I just kind of said, okay, well, let's go, rock and roll.
This is Etta James, recorded in 1961.
Oh, sometimes
I get a good feeling, yeah. Yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before, no, no.
Yeah.
I just want to tell you right now that
ooh.
I believe, I really do believe that something's got a hold on me here.
It wasn't too long after you moved in with your mother that you actually went on the road. I mean, Johnny Otis, who had a now famous rhythm and blues touring review, got you into the show. He discovered you. But how did you audition for him? How did you find him, or he find you?
Well, he really found me because at that time, I had ran away from home. And I went and I stayed with two girls, one named Abby and Jean, who later became the Peaches. You know, it used to be Etta James and the Peaches. We had wrote an answer to the song Work With Me, Annie.
The Hank Ballard record.
Right. So during those days, you know, everybody would make an answer. You'd said, Work With Me, Annie. Then we'd said, Roll With Me, Henry. And so one night, the young girl and myself, we were the same age. I think we were both like 16, and the older sister was like 24. And she went out to a dance in the Fillmore District, which was, you know, a heavy drag district of San Francisco. She went to see the Johnny Otis Band. All of a sudden, we got a call that night, and it was Abby calling us back to say, listen, guess who I'm with? I'm with Johnny Otis. And we go, oh, Johnny Otis. And he said, yeah, Johnny Otis, I told him that we have a girl group, and he says he wants to hear us. And I said, yeah, right. And she says, oh, he's at the hotel there, and all the band and everything. And myself and the girl, we looked at each other and said, yeah, right. Now we're 15-year-olds, and we're going to go to the hotel with the band and Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis was like about a 34, 35-year-old man. So we said, oh, no, that's all right. That's all right. We'll cool that and everything. So Johnny Otis snatched the phone from her. And it was Johnny Otis. You know, we heard that voice, you know. And he said, hi, how you doing? And we said, oh, we're doing all right. He says, I hear you guys got a great group. I hear you got a couple of songs, and I'd like to hear you. And he says, how about catching a cab? I'll pay the cab fare, and I'll meet you out front. He said, don't worry. Nobody's going to bother. He says, okay. So we got up and got dressed, got in the cab, and went down there. Sure enough, as we pulled up, we saw this tall man. You know, we'd all seen pictures of Johnny Otis with the nice hair, and he looked like a tall, kind of like a Creole man with a nice mustache and a beard, and he had, you know, and the nice pompadour hair. And when we got there, he said, oh, I'm glad to see you, and come on up and let's hear you. So we went upstairs to his room and we sang How Deep Is the Ocean and For All We Know and Street of Dreams.
So you auditioned for Johnny Otis. He liked your singing, I suppose,
right,
and invited you to go on the tour, but you were still a minor. Did you have to get your mother's permission?
Well, that was a trick there. I knew my mother wasn't going to let me go, but I told him, he says, how old are you? I said, 18, which he knew that was a lie. And he says, well, you know what? I would like to take you guys to Los Angeles tomorrow to make a record. And he says, can I speak with your mother? I said, no, I can't find her right now. She's working. And he says, well, can you go home and get permission from your mother, get something in writing stating that you can travel and you're allowed to travel with me and have her to sign it and date it? I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. So sure enough, that's what I did. I went home. I wrote the note,
Oh, I see. Right.
And I brought the note back with a tiny little bag, a little plastic bag or something with some clothes in it. And myself and the two girls got on Johnny's bus and we split to L.A.
So why don't we hear the first song that you recorded after going on the road with Johnny Otis? And it's Roll With Me, Henry, also called Wallflower.
And called Dance With Me, Henry.
Called Dance With Me, Henry also. And this is Etta James.
Hey, baby, what do I have to do to make you love me too?
You got to roll with me, Henry.
All right, baby.
Roll with me, Henry.
Don't mean maybe.
Roll with me, Henry.
Any old time.
Roll with me, Henry.
Won't change my mind.
Roll with me, Henry.
All right.
You better roll it while the rolling.
No, after you recorded this, Georgia Gibbs did a cover recording of this called "Dance with Me, Henry," and right. was that supposed to be the tamer version?
During those days, you weren't allowed to say "roll," because "roll" was like a vulgar word. You know what I mean? Think about it. They would probably burn Prince at the stake. Right? But you couldn't say "roll." So rather than they banned my record from the air. What we had to do was sell it underground, and not only that, change the title to Wallflower. And then when Georgia Gibbs did it, she just made the Dance With Me, Henry, so that, you know, all the kids could go buy it and, you know, take it home and, you know, listen to it. Because their parents weren't going to go for no roll. Are you kidding? Roll with me? How do you roll with somebody?
Etta James speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1994. James died last week at the age of 73. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview with Etta James, who died last week. They spoke in 1994, after James released the album Mystery Lady, which paid tribute to the great jazz singer Billie Holiday and won James the Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Performance.
At some point in your career, you started dressing in evening gowns for performances and dyeing your hair blonde. Tell me how you created that onstage image for yourself.
I think probably by me being so young, and I was oversized like I am now, but I mean, I had a real nice figure and I was tall. And I remember this singer, Joyce Bryant. She was a black singer, and I always admired her. And I had two role models. I liked Joyce Bryant because she wore fishtail gowns, sequin fishtail gowns, and she was black, and she had the nerve to wear platinum hair. And then I also loved Jane Mansfield, because Jane Mansfield had the blonde hair and had the poochy lips and the mole and all this. So I think what I did was kind of combined. My mother had bleached my hair carrot red at one point, and then I said, well, maybe that's not flamboyant enough. So I just kind of went into Detroit one day, and one of the fellows over there said, oh, Miss James, why, you would probably look fabulous with platinum hair. So he bleached my hair blonde, and it looked good. And what I was doing was trying to be a glamour girl, because I had been a tomboy most of the time, and I wanted to look grown. You know, I wanted to wear tall, high-heeled shoes and fishtail gowns and big, long rhinestone earrings, you know.
So how long did you dye your hair?
For how long?
Yeah.
I think, most of my career. It was blonde, platinum blonde, all the way, I would think, up into the 70s, maybe the 72 and 73, something like that.
And why'd you stop?
Well, I think things had changed. I know things had changed, and my career wasn't happening. And I didn't think that I needed to be that, you know, that to attract that much attention. Another thing, I was on drugs at that time, and I think I really wanted a low profile.
Hmm. Wait, was it difficult for you to give up drugs?
Not when I got down to, you know, I'd given it up many a time. You know, I'd kicked my habits many a time. But when I went in 1974, I gave heroin up. I was on methadone for maybe 3 or 4 years before that. So I had a couple of things to give up.
Was it hard to make a comeback after you stopped using?
No, not really, because when I stopped using, I wasn't the kind that went around and wanted people to pat me on the back about it. It's just that I just picked up the ball and started running with it. The thing was, when I went to this rehabilitation center, I was around nothing but a lot of white kids. And the thing where they were all younger than I was. And I remember on Saturdays, they would play all these great rock and roll records. The thing was, I was doing R&B, remember? But the ZZ Tops and the Rod Stewarts and the Rolling Stones and all those people, I was busy using drugs. I wasn't there when Woodstock. I was there in New York when Woodstock was going on, but I didn't want to go to Woodstock. I would rather go to Harlem, you know? And when I was in the program on Saturdays, we'd be cleaning up. They would be playing songs from all these people. And I would say, "Ooh, man, that music is really happening." And then what really made me think it is because my song, "I'd Rather Go Blind," they had a version of it by Rod Stewart. And they kept saying, "Hey, this is the song you wrote. Listen." And I said, "All right."
In 1978, you opened in some cities for the Rolling Stones on their tour. Were the Stones fans of yours?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, when I was in rehab at the same rehab center in the 70s, 74 and 75, I got a letter from Keith Richards that had said to me that they were getting ready to do a tour. You know, they had Tina Turner and they had B.B. King and they had different people on their tour. And they had wanted me on their tour. And the letter that they wrote came to the rehabilitation center, and the therapist got the letter, and he called me to his office and read the letter, and the letter said that he said, "We would like to have you on tour with us. We love your music." And he says, "But what you're doing right now is more important than what we could ever do with you, but we'll be sure to come back and get you when you're ready." And that was really cool. That was when they came back in 78 and kept their word.
I'd like to close our interview with another selection from your new album of songs that were recorded by Billie Holiday. I thought we could play "How Deep Is the Ocean," since this is one of the songs you sang many years ago when you auditioned for Johnny Otis. What do you think is the difference between what the song means to you now and what it meant to you then, and how you sing it now and how you sung it then?
Probably it's because now I really understand, you know what I mean? I understand what I'm singing about. You know, songs that I get, any song that I decide to sing or a song that someone sends to me or recommends, I like to be able to relate to that song, not just, you know, have a song there that talks about come fly me to the moon, let me dangle on the stars. That's not my cup of tea. That's not real. I want to sing real stuff. I want to know what I'm singing about, and I want to be able to really relate to that, and I think that's what I can do now. I think that's what I definitely do. Matter of fact, I know I do.
Etta James, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? Sprinkled with dew. Ooh, how far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to a star? And if I'd ever lost you, how much would I cry? How deep is the ocean? Baby, how high is the sky?
Etta James. Terry spoke with her in 1994. James died last week at the age of 73. This Sunday, HBO unveils its newest TV series. It's called Luck. It's set in and around the world of horse racing, and it's loaded with thoroughbred talent. David Milch created it. Michael Mann is the executive producer and directed the pilot. And the stars include Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
It isn't a long shot that David Milch's newest series for HBO, called Luck, will be on a par with his HBO series Deadwood. It's a sure thing. That's because HBO sent out all 9 episodes of the show's first season for preview, so there's no guesswork here. The racetrack is at the center of Luck, with every character and plotline orbiting around it. But you don't have to like horse racing or even understand it to get pulled in and swept along. It examines the track and its various intrigues from every possible perspective, from the owners and trainers of the horses to the jockeys riding them and the gamblers betting on them. We go from the executive suites to the stables, spending time getting to know the people and problems of each. It's like Downton Abbey with thoroughbreds. And speaking of thoroughbreds, that description extends to just about everyone working on Luck. What a collection of collaborators. David Milch hit it big before Deadwood with NYPD Blue in the 90s. Movie director Michael Mann produced 2 visually stunning TV series, Miami Vice and Crime Story, in the 80s. One of the biggest TV stars of Luck, Nick Nolte, became a star thanks to Rich Man, Poor Man in the 70s. And the other biggest star of Luck, Dustin Hoffman, is new to series television, but his stardom stretches all the way back to The Graduate in the 60s. And now, here they all are, doing great work at the same time. Milch throws us into the world of this California racetrack just as forcefully and as assuredly as he did when introducing us to the mining town of Deadwood. Mann directs the pilot with one eye as a documentarian and the other as an artist. Scenes and images look real, but often are beautiful, especially the racing scenes. The pictures, as well as the scripts, capture the raw power of the racehorses, who in the opening episodes often are reined in, waiting patiently for the proper time to break free and show their stuff. The actors are exactly the same way. Dustin Hoffman plays Ace Bernstein, a powerful player who's just been released after 3 years in prison. Nick Nolte plays Walter Smith, a former trainer who now owns a horse for which he has secret high hopes. And while the other actors and actresses in Luck spend the opening episodes establishing their talents as well as their characters, Hoffman and Nolte play it cool, biding their time in the rear of the pack, until, almost effortlessly, they stretch their muscles and show what they're made of. This is a sample from episode 3. Not a pivotal scene, just a nice one. Hoffman's ace is considering a young financial whiz in his business firm for a more lucrative job and summons the kid to his luxurious office for a private meeting. Patrick J. Adams plays the young man. Hoffman, as ace, shows his hand right away.
Do you make $1 million? Simple question.
No, sir.
Go home. Come back tomorrow. Tell me every thing you did between now and then. If I like what I hear, I'll give you $1 million for the next 12 months that you work for me.
Doing what?
That's the first thing you write down. Before I left her, I asked him a stupid question.
Hoffman plays Ace like a coiled snake, while Nolte plays his character like a battered veteran boxer. And there's so much other talent on screen, singling out some would almost be unfair to the others. But if you're a Deadwood fan, you'll see some familiar faces. You'll see them from other superb TV shows as well. Eventually, you'll even see Michael Gambon, star of my favorite TV miniseries of all time, The Singing Detective. Finally, there are the horses, these majestic creatures who are called upon at times to share scenes and interact with various human cast members. How the horses react to each person, that feels primal, honest, real. And so does luck. The way this HBO series jumps out of the gate this first season, it'll be back for another lap around the track. Bet on it.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.